the UCR Podcast.
We lost the great Brian Wilson this week at the age of 82, and this is another one of those moments in music history where we are seeing just an incredible universal outpouring of tributes and memories from fans, musicians, Brian's many bandmates and collaborators, and I certainly have been down my own rabbit hole this whole week listening to Brian's music, and I wanted to talk about things with somebody who has taken a very similar path with Brian's career, his music with the Beach Boys, and so on. And that is UCR's own Jeff Giles, who outside of Ultimate Classic Rock, we have spent hours and maybe even days and weeks talking about Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, and a bunch of other musical subjects that we probably don't need to get into right now because they're just so obscure it would make your brain hurt. But this is what we do. But Jeff, I appreciate you taking some time to join up with me here today and, you know, talk about Brian, because obviously for us as music fans, this is something that I think we've known more and more here in the past, you know, year that this day would probably be coming, but it's still, you know, for us as music fans, it's a sad day, a sad time.
It's a sad day, but he had a good run, right? Who would have guessed that Brian would be the last Wilson Brothers? You know,
for sure.
He lived multiple lifetimes in those 82 years and went through a lot. And so, yeah, it's sad that he's no longer with us. But on the other hand, simply by virtue of all that classic music and those wonderful songs, like they say, he will always be with us in his music. And also, I think, you know, he went through a lot. So, it's nice to think of him being at peace now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, to kind of look at the music, like, what did you kind of appreciate from your side of things about Brian Wilson creatively, musically, artistically, and all of that? Because he's just one of these guys that, as you and I both have come to know, just brought so much to the table, you know, from an artistic perspective and beyond.
Yeah, way to lead off with an easy question there. What did I appreciate about Brian Wilson in all these different ways? Brian's music is one reason that I wish I knew more about theory so I could really talk to you about what made him unique from a compositional standpoint. I can't break that down. I can only tell you how his best music made me feel at that moment of discovery, like the first time I heard God Only Knows, realizing I was listening to it. I'm sure it was part of the background at some point earlier, but when you hear those harmonies, when you hear what he does with voices, there's never been anybody else who could do or did what he did. And then you put on top of that his incredible gift for melody, you know. I guess I'm kind of a lyrics guy. I can appreciate a good rhythm section, a nice tight pocket, but melody is king. And for Brian, I don't know, can you think of a more talented melody maker?
No, when you look at just the early endorsements that he got, you know, early on, in the height of it all, if Paul McCartney is hailing you already at the time when Pet Sounds comes out, the fact that he got buy-in from some of those guys alone at a time when, you know, basically there obviously was, like, at least on paper, reasons for there to be a rivalry between those two camps. And from what I know and recall, Paul let his guard down on that, whatever might have existed, pretty early on, and just stepped up and said, man, this stuff is unbelievable. He basically, in a 60s Paul McCartney way, was probably one of the early people to say, okay, I do have to step forward and admit, this makes me jealous. I can't do something like this, which is weird to hear me say something like that being Paul McCartney, but even if this is not something that I feel like I could do myself personally, he immediately recognized it as being an incredible piece of work. And I think that's kind of the short version of what I'm trying to say here is that that's kind of the best compliment that you can get from your peers when they basically just step forward and say, look, whatever you think is the most incredible thing I've done, put all that to the side. Who cares? Because I want you to look at this album that this guy crafted, that this band has put out, because this is something truly very special. So anytime you see like peers like that, that have already done things that, as we know now, are going to be desert island discs for many years and decades into the future, anytime you have folks like that that kind of step forward and step outside of their own limelight to kind of use some of that limelight to, you know, shine the spotlight on somebody else, I think that's all the endorsement you need at that point. And I mean, that, as they say, that's game recognizing game, right?
You know. Yeah. Can we safely assume that everybody listening to this is aware of the musical arms race between McCartney and Wilson? You know, that it went from Rubber Soul to Pet Sounds to Sgt. Pepper to almost.
It was an incredible back and forth. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You're correct. I don't know that everybody at this point, or a lot of people, unless you were there or, you know, growing up in the couple of decades that followed, I think you're right to presume that at this point, that is a rivalry and competition that there are probably many folks at this point that are not aware of that. But boy, like when you talk about, like, I don't know how much, I think that it still happens because we still hear artists talk about how, you know, hearing, like, say, that particular record by Jason Isbell, you know, inspired me to want to do this. Like, it's been a thing that's been going on for a long time where it's like somebody is inspired by a particular record, and that just, if the band and artist jumped two steps with the album that they put out, then their competitor, their kind of peer, their kind of perceived equal goes, that's cool that they jumped two steps. Now I'm going to jump three steps up this staircase. I mean, you know, I think the famous episode is like, what is it? Hendrix playing, like, you know, music from Sgt. Pepper, like 2 days after it came out or so, like with, like, you know, a Beatle or two in the audience. Like, it's like, this is the stuff that since the beginning of musical time, it's been awesome as a music fan to get to witness, or at the very least for the two of us, get to hear about later, like, oh man, that's a great story. Or that's a great bit of shade that they put down there in response to what the guy put out that they were so proud of, you know? Like, so it's just like the musical kind of tug of war and back and forth that has gone on between some of these now musical giants through the decades is amazing. Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up, because that was really, you're right. As a music fan, that was one of the more fascinating volleys to witness, you know, again, for us after the fact, but just to be able to kind of just chart what went down in that relatively short period of years between those two. Fascinating.
Yeah. You're talking like what, 65 to 67, 68. Yeah, I mean, aside from being one of the great rivalries to witness and listen to, those guys were laying the foundation for everything to follow. You know, they were, I don't know if I'd say they were writing the rules, but there was a lot less for them to build on or fall back on when they were making those records. They were kind of in uncharted territory, and they've really stood the test of time. And it ends with Brian flaming out. It ends with Brian trying to create his masterpiece and Smile and not being able to get there. And it, when that happens, it creates this image around Brian as the like kind of this broken genius that either needs to be coaxed back into active duty every few years or needs to be protected from either himself or people who are ostensibly there to take care of him. Like, you know, Dr. Landy, like it's long decades long narrative around Brian as somebody who's forever just one or two steps away from delivering the greatest album of all time.
And I think that's what's been kind of interesting about, like, you and I talked about this a little bit, but it's just like, I think that's what's been interesting about kind of the reassessment that is happening as we speak here in the past few years, with kind of the, what we'll call the later Beach Boys records, you know, predominantly, in a sense, the albums, especially that emerged during the 70s. And ultimately, what was just a tough period for the Beach Boys. But, you know, the other podcast that you and I do called The Record Player, it's like we had Howie Edelson on, who, of course, you know, works with the Beach Boys organization. And it's been... So it was great. I mentioned that just for people that, you know, want to kind of take a further trip down the rabbit hole. Like, anytime you can listen to somebody like Howie just kind of like just talk in depth, very historically about all of that. Like, Howie, we wanted to kind of go down that rabbit hole and really kind of explore a little bit of that time period, and that did not disappoint. But I guess my overall point is that. You said something important when you were talking about how Brian kind of broke. Mm-hmm. And then from that point, every once in a while, there were just these flashes of brilliance that would emerge. And that's what I think happened, like, in various ways with a lot of those records that are now being reassessed. Because, like, the song that you and I were talking about yesterday was a song from the Sunflower record called It's About Time. That I was listening to, you know, just driving, I was streaming it, and I was like listening to it. And, you know, kind of when I started thinking about, like, just like some of the really crazy, brilliant productions that Brian had overseen, orchestrated, and helped to pilot into the world over the years, one of the first songs I always think of is Heroes and Villains. So that's mm-hmm. kind of like my initial kind of go-to when I think about just a brilliant production. But, you know, as I was like listening to what I was listening to was I was actually listening to the Made in California box set, which I think came out around 2013 or so. And that is on streaming. And I want to recommend that for people that are looking for an interesting rabbit hole to go down, because it's got, like, I don't know, 170, 175 tracks. It is massive. And what I like about it, and we kind of got like an early glimpse of this type of thing, I think, back in the 90s with the Good Vibrations box set. It kind of continues in that vein because it's got big hits, but it's also got alternate versions, things that are deeper cuts, things that never quite came out in that way. Because I think that this box set predated the Smile Sessions box set by a few years. So there was some Smile stuff on there. And, but what I love about it is, like, here's some stuff that's like full productions, finished songs as you remember them. Here's some stuff that is like just certain parts of songs that later evolved to a different form, but you haven't necessarily heard them in that form. Here's some live stuff from all sorts of different eras. Like, it's just a really interesting trip. But the particular song was It's About Time from the Sunflower record. That was what came up as I was shuffling through that box set. And what struck me, which is interesting in the whole Beatles, Beach Boys kind of time continuum, is that that specific song, It's About Time, just made me think of everything in the kitchen sink that's thrown into that song in a way that immediately kind of took me back to, like, listening to, like, the long suite on the Abbey Road record, and just like everything that was just happening from a sonic standpoint. And what I've always loved about that kind of stuff, and to keep it like on the Beach Boys side of things, something like that or something like Heroes and Villains, is that for us as young listeners at the time who were just, you know, kind of starting to make our way in the world in that vein of things, those were fascinating songs to hear. Songs like a song like Heroes and Villains, that, like, as you're just listening to it, it's just like, it's set up in a way that it very quickly takes you away to a certain world, in this case for about, I think the, we'll call it the single version of Heroes and Villains is just about 3.5, close to 4 minutes, but it takes you away to a world in that relatively short period of time that even in that time span, you're sitting there going, as a kid, you're going, I could spend a lot of time here. I don't know where they are right now, but this seems like a really cool place that I don't know if there's a way for me to visit this place, but man, just everything I'm hearing right now, I'd like to go there. So I think that there was, it's almost like, I don't know how far I want to peel the onion back here, but you know, it's almost like Brian, for the things that he struggled with in a sense, they opened up other things that I'm not sure if he hadn't been the person that he was, I'm not sure that he would have been able to explore music in the same way that he did.
Sure. Absolutely. Of course. That would be, that's true for anybody, right? It's true for, Ted Nugent.
It's certain. Well, yeah, but it, yeah, you're right. Like it's circumstance. Like it's whatever that circumstance is that ultimately kind of like draws the path of where you go from there. Yeah. I think
I am jealous that you heard Heroes and Villains as a kid. I think the only Beach Boys stuff that I heard as a young listener was the same crap that everybody else heard. And for me, you know, I figure when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, it was like the stuff, the new stuff on the radio, the top 40, that was in color. And Help Me, Rhonda, and you know, Little Deuce Coupe and all this, that's in black and white. So, you know, I never, those songs when I was young, In My Room, Surfer Girl, like none of that really meant anything to me. That was the soundtrack to a bygone era. That was my parents' music. That it didn't really do anything for me. And then of course, you get the Beach Boys doing Wipeout with the Fat Boys. You get the Beach Boys doing Kokomo. And the less said about Kokomo, the better. But that period was really not them at their best. For somebody who was our age in the 80s, I think the Beach Boys really didn't do a very good job of drawing you in. They were already in a place where they were playing, you know, every so often they would put out a new record and they would try to have hits with that, but they were already in a place where primarily they were touring behind the stuff, like singles that were hits prior to Pet Sounds. That was what they were resting on at that point. And I was thinking about this when you were talking about stuff like Heroes and Villains and talking about things like Sunflower and the records that they made in the 70s, you know, it's very, very common for an act of that stature to say, we're more than the hits. You know, like you hear it all the time from Daryl Hall. I'm tired of playing these same hit singles. We've got such a deep bench of great material. With the Beach Boys, not only is that true, but it's in many cases substantially different from what you think you know about the Beach Boys. If you're a very casual listener and all you've heard is the Sun and Fun stuff, you're missing out on an awful lot. There's a lot of breadth and depth to that catalog that I think millions of casual listeners are unaware of, even in spite of the countless Beach Boys compilations that have come out. You know, they're much more interesting than I think a lot of people realize.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, like knowing that like you do the thing where it's like you'll, you know, with streaming, you'll do like the full catalog, like listen or re-listen. How far have you gone in that vein with Beach Boys? Have you taken that trip?
So I remain the type of fan who doesn't have a lot of interest in the things that in the early stuff, the big hits, really is not my thing. It's really for me Pet Sounds and everything, well not everything, but Pet Sounds and some of what came after. So in the 90s when Capitol was reissuing all of those post Pet Sounds records, that's when I bought them and I listened to them. So, you know, like Carl and the Passions, So Tough, and Holland.
You bought that stuff. I love that.
I did, and Smiley Smile and Surf's Up.
Because those twofers were attractive. Like, they had good liner notes, and it's like, so yeah, like music nerds, like, they packaged it the right way. Like, we're going to give you two records, but also we're going to tell you about these two records. I appreciate that.
And I think they start to run out of gas toward the end of the decade. I would not recommend that anybody listen to like Light Album or MIU or certainly the stuff that came in the 80s, but for a while after Brian went into seclusion, they were more than Brian. Let's say that, you know, Carl stepped up, Dan stepped up. There's a lot more talent in that group and a lot more to the catalog than I think a lot of people realize.
I think also that just because of like when they came out as a band and the span of the band, they were one of those bands that also liked the Beatles, but I could also say this about Genesis and Yes and lots of other things. Like Moody Blues is one that I think of a lot. They were a band that like their sound was evolving as technology evolved and like that, some of their experiences, things that they were getting into with like, you know, like the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and, you know, that kind of spiritual journey and all that kind of stuff. Like there were a lot of different factors that were playing into where they went with these records. But I think that technology was part of it. Like suddenly they had like more sounds and more tracks to experiment with. And that wasn't just even in like the, if we look at Smile, for example, and just all the theatrics that Brian was able to put into the music, using that as an example, they also just had some really interesting sounds. You know, I mean, the easiest one that like everybody has definitely heard is like the use of the theremin on Good Vibrations. You know, it's just like as the years passed, and there weren't a bunch of years that passed, but as the years were passing, the palette of what they had to work with was expanding at a fairly rapid rate. And so I think that's what was – I like how you referenced the early stuff as kind of like the sun and fun period, because that's what it is. But it's almost like as they kind of start to go down some more grown-up avenues, some darker avenues there was more at their disposal to be able to make that authentic from a sonic perspective. You know, I mentioned this to you, but hearing the song Surf's Up for the first time from an 8-track that I bought like at the thrift store, like as I was like, you know, buying these like 8-tracks, like 40 or 50 8-tracks for like a quarter each and just bringing home all these albums. You know, yes, to this day, I can remember listening to Surf's Up and hearing the song Surf's Up for the first time on an 8-track. But like, I think that they could have done a song like Surf's Up in the Sun and Fun era, but it would not have had the same tone and the same emotional impact because of where technology was at that point. I think that part of what helped them to a point as they started to get into those, I mean, come on, man. God Only Knows is one of the arguably most perfect songs of all time. Certainly they had the ability to achieve and make emotional impact. It's not like it wasn't happening, but it's like, I just think that like as the headspace, the sonic headspace kind of like expanded in different ways, anybody that's, you know, listening on headphones or even just like through a really good pair of speakers as the stereo systems got better, you took more of a journey. And I guess that's one good thing about I don't know. It's, again, we don't want to tread into dangerously close to get off my lawn territory, but you know, we're in this, as we are in this streaming age and everybody is, you know, walking around and has their headphones on, I do kind of like the idea that like, even if it's, there are people that will like argue about, you know, how good those headphones are or are not, I think the positive thing is that we have Hopefully a good amount of folks that are like listening to music on headphones and not just through crappy laptop speakers, which for the artist for the past, you know, 10, 15 years has been the argument, is that they've been making albums that ultimately are just heard through laptop speakers. And why am I doing that? So I think we're getting back to that in a sense where it's like, you see people that are concerned about getting themselves, at the very least, even if like the idea of a stereo system is maybe passe at this point, I do encounter a lot of people that are in their teens and sometimes 20s that are like looking to get a good pair of like over the ear headphones that I never thought I'd see that come back. Like, that is not the majority, but they're out there. Like the guy that produces the radio show that I do for Ultimate Classic Rock, like, it's just like, we're constantly talking about bands. Like, I think he's like in his, you know, mid to late 20s. And it's just like, he talks with like I'm like, how have you heard of some of these bands? So it's just kind of, I think that's what I enjoy, is that like, I enjoy that like there are still people, however they get down that rabbit hole, there are still people that are taking that kind of journey. But, you know, to get back on topic after going way off the rails, that was... That's what I loved about like listening to something like Surf's Up, was just the way it sounded, let alone what was being put forth from an emotional standpoint, was really something to behold. Even if I realize now that I was listening to it on less than optimal 8-track technology,
it doesn't matter. Even
still, it doesn't matter. Like, it's just like, I think ultimately somebody would argue that like the delivery system is not important. It is right. Ultimately about the song and the way that song was crafted, and you know, at the end of the day, that's all that matters. But you know, you and I have talked about this, but it's just like, I think that's something that we heard it again in some of those earlier songs, but just the journey that Brian was taking as we got further into the decade and then into the subsequent decade, you and I have both seen this, where it's just like he expressed vulnerability in a way that almost gave subsequent artists, and we've seen some of these folks express that, felt like they had the license to express things then at that point, that prior to, you know, some folks like Brian Wilson, not like Brian was the only person doing that, but he was one of the important people doing that, that kind of put that onto a record. I would say a song, you know, from like, say, Paul McCartney of the Beatles, like Yesterday is another example, but like people like that, putting stuff like that onto records, suddenly, you know, maybe made fellow musicians and sometimes just music fans feel like that they could express themselves in ways that they had not felt like they could express themselves prior to that. So
I agree with that.
There's a lot.
I think
there's a lot to unpack.
I think rock historians could quibble over who was really the first male singer-songwriter to express that type of vulnerability. But Brian really did put himself out there. I do think he helped pave the way for other singer-songwriters, particularly male ones, to be comfortable being open and vulnerable in that way. Maybe part of what made Brian's vulnerability unique is that it came within the context of this surf group. And, you know, when you see like these bronze gods carrying their surfboards around looking for chicks or whatever, vulnerability is the last thing you expect. You would think that these guys all come across like villains in a teen 80s movie, right? They've got it all. But Brian added a real sweetness, a melancholy to that acted as a really effective tonic for even those early hits. He I think started to embrace that sadness, that melancholy more as time went on, and Talking about that 70s stuff and thinking about all the different things that they did after their initial run of success underscores to me what a tragedy it was when the Beach Boys decided that they were going to fall back on formula, that they were not really interested anymore in doing anything different. They just really started trying to serve up different varieties of those early hits, you know, Kokomo being a prime example. And I think that's too bad.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, and it's, I'm glad you said that because it's interesting. I was like, just talking to a couple of the guys from the Alice Cooper group yesterday and hearing about how they were playing like large venues, like a Madison Square Garden, and still getting kind of like just, there was just this prevailing thought that they couldn't play, that they weren't a real band, all that kind of stuff. And so what you said,
another thing that dogged the Beach Boys forever, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. So that's like that really, you really jogged the idea that, like, I think that obviously, like, you know, the Monkees, like their catalog, there are a lot of songs and albums that people hold dear now that because they were the Monkees in the time, they caught a lot of shit and it took decades for them to come close to shedding any of that and getting any level of what felt like respect outside of so that was a big thing. That is to say that in that time, and again, this is not something that has gone away, there are still, you know, really talented, you know, pop singer songwriters, bands, whatever, that because of the nature of what they do, it's like they're just dismissed. But Beach Boys, certainly you're correct, like that there was a certain hurdle to get over because of the whole surfer thing, because of the whole sun and fun thing, that I can only imagine that, like, I don't think we have to imagine some of that. I think that some of it's been documented, the idea that, like, when they started going down this path, I am sure that, like, the record label was not thrilled at some of the stuff that was being brought in. So, yeah, that's an important bit of perspective to point out, that that was something else that they were up against.
Also didn't help that Brian basically fired them from the studio, you know, that he started making records with session ringers instead of them. But they were much more of a band than they were given credit for at many points.
100%. I think you see that. I was talking about this with Annie earlier, my wife, for people who might not know that, but just like she brought up as we were talking about all this, something that you know very well, and just like how complex the issue of like the Beach Boys songwriting credits is. And it's like, even with like the credits that are out there, you had, you know, Brian, or you had, you know, Mike Love, that were saying, look, I know that's what the credit says, but I wrote that song with Mike, or Mike says he wrote this part of the song. I actually wrote that. So that's something else that you have to contend with too, is that, like, basically there's a lot of different versions of the story depending on who you're talking to about that story. So, but
I mean, I think for a certain type of person, the Beach Boys may be even more interesting as a behind the scenes story than they are as a musical group. I don't know if I would consider myself part of that group. I think, you know, clearly there's a big story there. There have been multiple documentaries about it. There have been multiple films about it. A lot of it is sad. I don't know. I could easily be here with you for an hour and insult certain members of the Beach Boys, but
sure.
Today, now that Brian's no longer with us, I just want to think about how great he was, instead of, you know, doing what I would normally do and saying some profane things about people that I think maybe didn't serve him so well.
What do you think were some of the gateways that Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys opened up for you? Or are there kind of like interesting gateways that you can kind of point to now that like were kind of points of transition that came as a result of kind of following and immersing yourself in their music? I know that like there's parts of this that for you, everybody takes their own interesting path with a group and with an artist. So it's just like, and you kind of spoke to this a little bit just a few seconds ago, just like, you know, the story behind the band that, you know, just the story behind the band versus their music, like just like what a rabbit hole that is. Like, I mean, as you and I were talking about, like, it's just like at a time when there weren't like a ton of rock books, like I read like, you know, Heroes and Villains by Stephen Gaines. I think it's called Heroes and Villains, The True Story of the Beach Boys. So when I'm at my local library in the 80s and I saw that book in the very limited stack of music books, I'm like, I'm taking this home immediately. And I was, it was, and again, like I did, there's a documentary that you and I have talked about called Beach Boys, an American Band, that our pal David Leibowitz has the same double feature DVD that I do, which has Beach Boys, an American Band, and then the Brian Wilson, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times documentary on one DVD. And I really need to go back and watch the An American Band documentary because I can't remember if it was like totally airbrushed and did not really like share any of the kind of darkness behind the scenes or if it depicted some of that. But I know that between the two, you know, it's like, I think it was kind of that documentary where it's like, I see these guys with, you know, beards and all this kind of stuff. It's like, where are the clean cut Beach Boys that I, you know, initially became aware of. So that was kind of how that got uncovered a little bit, was seeing that documentary and then reading that Heroes and Villains books. It was just like reading that book. It was like, these guys, they had some stuff going on behind the scenes that would have killed 12 other bands before the end of the week. And meanwhile, eventually, 60 years later, there's still a version of the Beach Boys that exists. Like, when you read some of the stuff about the Beach Boys story, it's just like there's all kinds of things that, like, you can read any one of those that'll just make you go, I can't believe this book. I can't believe this band survived a week, let alone a month, let alone many additional years. So I do think that like they have like just a lot of interesting lines that extend out. Certainly guys like Van Dyke Parks and, you know, a little bit further down the timeline, a guy like Andy Paley and so on. So just like looking at some of the songwriters that ultimately collaborated with, you know, Brian, and just, you know, songwriters and producers that collaborated with, you know, Brian and other people in the group and so on. Like, for us as liner note nerds, there were a lot of interesting paths to follow, I think.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. That's the one for me. That's the, that documentary was probably the major gateway for me. That's the big touchstone. I think that's, if you're curious about Brian or if you're any kind of fan, I think it's well worth watching. At this point, I don't know how much information is in it. It would be new to anybody, but I think it does a really wonderful job of not only telling a version of the complete story that acknowledges the sadness of his life as well as the triumphs, but it also does a really good job of breaking down what made some of those compositions unique and special. I can't remember his name, but one of the talking heads in the movie is a professor of music at some university. Mm. And I think he breaks down, I want to say it's The Warmth of the Sun, which that is a song that does not do melodically what I think a lot of people would expect it to do. And this guy shows you how and shows you why. He's sitting at a piano. And that movie for me was, it came along at the right time when I was ready to finally hear something in Brian's music and the Beach Boys music that I hadn't before. And it also, it makes a really persuasive case for him as an artist. So I'm glad you name checked it. If you don't have it and you haven't seen it, you should.
I generally hate projects like that, but the right guy was involved with that. Like, I'm really happy that,
What do you mean that projects like that? What do you like that you were afraid that it would be too sanitized or what?
We have things sometimes that like you can just kind of almost see in this age where it's like you see like a trailer, you can almost see like kind of the direction that's going to take. And there's, as you say, there's going to be like a lot of talking heads. And, you know, I talked to Derek Trucks at one point in recent years about like how they watch a lot of documentaries on the bus as they're out and about playing shows and how they would sit around like making fun of the various talking heads and documentaries. And at one point he's like, we were watching a documentary and I think maybe it was like the B.B. King documentary and they had been doing some of that usual behavior. And then he started to realize like, I think I'm in this documentary. So there's a certain kind of music fan that you just kind of have an impression of what you're going to get. And, but at the same time, I was far enough along, as I think you were as well, that as soon as I saw Don was involved, I'm like, all right, good. We're in good hands here. You know? So that was what I was really going to say was that like, I am glad that that project ultimately put Don and Brian like in the same, you know, room to be able Don's been in the room to give some good juju and take some good juju in return from some of our favorite artists over the years. And whatever his thing is, you know, and it's like we can spend a lot of time talking about that, but it's just like he's one of those guys that like very much I think like which is why I think it's appropriate that he's been part of these tours paying tribute to the band in recent years, because just like I think that he has a certain vibe, a certain mojo that reminds me what I thought of as I was talking about Don. I thought about like Garth Hudson in the band. Like they're just certain guys that just the vibe of the guy that's in the room. It's like, you like that guy, you know? So.
Yeah. I'm still bitter that we never got a studio album from Don and Brian, that it ended the soundtrack, because the soundtrack, I'm glad we're still talking about this, because the soundtrack to this movie is also a big part of what drew me in. That those Beach Boys records are brilliant, but they can also be awfully, I don't know, candy-coated sweet.
For sure.
Yeah. And especially, you know, coming after the first Brian Wilson solo album, which is produced within an inch of its life, the way that Don was recontextualizes Brian's work on that soundtrack is, I think, not only brilliant, but really, it just does a really wonderful job of illustrating the strength of those songs, apart from the trappings that you're accustomed to with the original recordings. Instead of the Beach Boys, he's got Sir Harry and Sweet Pea doing background vocals, which, I mean, come on. There's kind of barely a band there. It's a piano-based record. It's very stripped down, but it isn't like a Johnny Cash American Recordings type thing. It's not like a Rick Rubin production, but it is very spare, and it highlights the strengths, the musical strengths of those numbers. And yeah, man, when that came out and I saw that Don was involved and that Brian was signed to his label, we were going to get a record from them. I still don't know what the hell happened, but to go from that to the Imagination record was a pretty jarring switch. And I wish, be nice to go down an alternate timeline and hear the album that might have been.
Yeah. I agree. And there's a lot of that in the story of Brian Wilson. One of the things you and I were talking about is that coincidentally, the week that we're finding out that Brian Wilson is gone, earlier in the week, I'd talked to Al Jardine, and we didn't get too far down this path, but one of the things that was interesting to me, is just the idea that, as we know, it's like Brian ends up not completing Smile, putting that on the shelf. It was a very damaging experience, you know, and then it's like, if you get further into like the 70s, there's the Beach Boys Love You album, and there's the album that is supposed to come out of that called Adult Child that gets shelved. And it's like, so yeah. There's when you talk about the things that happened or were supposed to happen or didn't happen, it's just like these guys could be one of those groups that we could be hearing music from them for a long time just because of all the things that were supposed to happen, partially happened, yeah. or whatever the case was that have not. And I know that like at the time that I was just seeing Andy Paley's widow writing about this in her Substack, but it's just like Andy prior to his passing had been kind of reaching out to Brian periodically because there was stuff that they had done that he wanted to kind of see that through and see that stuff. Yeah. But see that stuff get finished and come out. So it's just like, so it's there. Brian is just one of those artists that for everything, it's just a fascinating thing to examine because for everything that we have, sometimes what it took to get to that crazy, you know?
Yeah. And hazardous to people's health. Yeah. When you talk about that, I'm thinking about how that, all that stuff, all those lost projects and the continual cries every 5 to 10 years of Brian's back. I think it feels crass to say it, but I think it added to the mystique around Brian, and it probably helped him maintain people's interest in the long run. The music itself, like you've heard Adult Child, you've heard Sweet Insanity, you've heard the Landylocked stuff. In many, many, many cases, the music itself does not hold up to the amount of scrutiny that surrounds it simply because it is not readily available. I guess it is now. You could probably hear anything you want on YouTube right now, but for a long time, you know, starting with Smile and then going on from there, there was just like this legend around this stuff that he had, this supposedly brilliant stuff that he had written, recorded, and then abandoned. And you couple that with this continual feeling that Brian is always just like one or two people away from finally putting it together and getting back on the track that he was at during the Pet Sounds and Smile era. If you just get Landy out of the way, or if you just get him away from Mike, or if you just, get him away from Joe Thomas, whatever. There was a long, long, long period of time when you were waiting for all those pieces to fall into place. I'm not sure that they ever really did. And I think that a lot of Brian's problems were, a lot of those wounds were, you know, self-inflicted. And I'm sure he, as brilliant as he was not maybe the easiest guy to work with.
I can understand that. I wanted to ask you, like, do you think that the Landy period, as complicated as it was, do you think that was ultimately a good thing for keeping Brian around in any form?
Awful hard to say, right? I mean,
he
did not seem to be somebody who was destined to be around for very long prior to Landy coming into his life. Then you look at the way he was after, and he obviously lived many years after Landy was removed from the picture. But he also, I mean, I love the guy. I'm not making fun of him, but you see interview clips with him from the last, I don't know, 40 years of his life. And he was a different guy. There was, he was further removed from the plane of reality that you and I share than he had been before. So I don't know. I'm thinking about a conversation that I had with Christopher Cross once in the late 90s. He was part of, there was a documentary when the Imagination record came out, and he was part of that. I think it's him and Carl singing.
Yeah.
And I said something like, oh man, that must have been a huge thrill for you. And he kind of sighed a little bit, and he said words to the effect of that he had always been a Carl guy. He was closer with Carl. But obviously Brian was an enormous influence on his work. And then he said, you know, when you meet him, when you're in the room with him, when you talk to him now, that's not Brian. You know, he is not that guy. He's not the same guy that he was before. So I don't know. It's a really complicated question about Landy. I'm sure that he, to the extent that he became a villain, similar to Mike Love in the story, I think some of that stuff is probably overblown. I'm sure he didn't do as much good as he thought he was doing. But yeah, to your point, we got another several decades of Brian after Landy came into the picture. So I don't know. That's the short answer to your question. I don't know.
No, I like it. It's a complicated answer. It's a complicated question. So I think that you tackled that one about as best as anybody could. I will, you know, for folks that like want to listen to something, Carney Wilson spoke to Billy Corgan. Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins has a podcast called The Magnificent Others. And she talked to Billy for probably about an hour and a half. And I would say that like somewhere in the midst of it, like it's not like a lot of these interviews where it's like you would expect the person to talk to Carney about, you know, Wilson Phillips or whatever else for 10, 15 minutes and then talk to her about Brian for the remaining hour plus. It doesn't go down that way, which I appreciate. Like they, you know, probably spend 20 minutes or so at the most, you know, talking about Brian, and, you know, she kind of shares how she reestablished or really kind of established a relationship with her father and how much that meant. And, you know, kind of, I think, give some good context to where he was for this past year. And the thing that like I enjoyed hearing her say was that she would see him about 3 times a month or so. And I had kind of some of these similar moments with my dad. So I think that kind of gives me an added layer of appreciation. But in this case with her dad, what she would do was she would sing some of his favorite songs to him. And sometimes some of her own favorite songs, but just basically her point in sharing that was that like, basically she was able to kind of communicate with him using music in that way. And so I think that that's one thing that I appreciate, is that in a sense, the one thing that kind of stayed consistent, as you say, through the last, let's say, 30 or 40 years, was that this was a guy that always maintained his love for the music, even if like he had a hard time dealing with some of what that entailed. You know, you and I have talked about, like, for instance, just like his complicated relationship with the stage as a performer. You know, like that was stuff that like was not easy for him going way far back, and it right. became progressively more difficult as the years passed. Like, you know, it's funny because I mentioned the tour that Brian did with Jeff Beck when I talked to, you know, Al Jardine. And the thing that I appreciated about that tour was, as you and I have talked about, like when he returned to the stage, like say, you know, near the end of the 90s into the early 2000s and so on, like he had the Wonderments, you know, working with him and as his group, and they really were able to kind of communicate his music in such an authentic way that supported, but it felt like they were approaching it from a healthy standpoint. You know, like when I got that, I think that you got to see Brian somewhere in that general era around the time he put out that Live at the Roxy record. Like you saw him sometime in that general era, right? With the one.
Yeah, I saw him. I saw him on the 99 tour. Yeah. And that was bucket list moment, man.
We never thought we'd see it.
Never thought. No, absolutely not. And I was deep into my Brian Beach Boys phase at that time. So that was just the cherry on top. But yeah, that was a top five concert for me. And I saw him again after that and started to feel like maybe I was witnessing some form of elder abuse. Like his discomfort on the stage was much more apparent to me. He didn't seem nearly as engaged. And maybe that's just because I wasn't swept up in it the way that I was the first time. I don't know. But so many of these things with Brian are complicated. Like, I'm so glad I got to see that show. Was it kindness to put him on the road? You know, did he really want to be there? I don't know. And then he ended up touring for a very long time after that. And was that all his decision, or was it because it was lucrative? I don't know. I don't know any. Yeah, it's hard for me.
Yeah, I think that's one of the ongoing questions is like how long should have gone on. But I'll tell you, when I saw that 2013 show, the spirit that was kind of common with what you talked about seeing in 1999 was that like it was the year after the Beach Boys reunion tour. So he had Al Jardine on stage with him. He had David Marks, and then he had like just an assortment of, you know, various folks that had been in the circle over the years. So like, there was a special feeling to that. Like, I know from talking to Al, like it meant a lot for him to be able to get out and play shows with Brian the way he did for, you know, the past how many ever years. That meant a lot. And that's what I saw in that 2013 show, which is why I brought it up, was that like similar to the affection and love that the Wondermints had, you know, and have for Brian, you know, this was one of those tours that you like see it on paper. You're like, how's that going to go? And I got to tell you, man, it was really something seeing just the reverence that Jeff Beck had for Brian and how much it meant for Jeff to come out on stage and be able to play some of his favorite songs with the guy that was the architect, you know? So that was, I think I'm kind of glad that I kind of cut it off there. Like, that was like, again, it was kind of a show that I wasn't sure what I was going to get. I knew I was a Brian Wilson fan. I knew I was a Jeff Beck fan. Wasn't sure how that was going to go together. And so I think that everybody I've talked to that got to witness that show kind of walked away with the same feeling, like it was a special time. So, you know, Jeff, I mean, we could go on and on and on talking about Brian Wilson. We're up against it here in the proverbial podcast terms. So the good news is we have like all sorts of stuff that people can read and enjoy at Ultimate Classic Rock as we kind of just go deeper into everything that Brian has done, you know, both now and the stuff that we've written in the past. Like, there's a lot if people want to go down the rabbit hole. I think there's some tools there. I think that, Jeff, I think that you certainly have shared some good things today as far as, you know, things that people can pursue and check out if they kind of, you know, want to spend some time, whether it's the first time or whether they're going back to an area of their music fandom that they haven't visited in a while. I agree with you, like that. I just wasn't made for these times. Documentary, is a fun watch. And, I'm just glad we got to do this today. So thank you for taking some time to you know, talk music and talk about Brian Wilson, because this is one of the big ones. You know, we're obviously seeing more of these as the years pass, but this is one that I knew we both had a lot of mutual affection for. And so there we go. If we gave one person today something to listen to or check out or reconsider, I guess we've done our job, right?
We have.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.